Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's Brian Lehrer, and this is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Tuesday, July 28th. So what does the President of the United States do on the day they announce his national security advisor has COVID-19, and as the nationwide death toll hovers around 1,000 lives lost every day, and he is sinking in the re-election polls for his handling of the pandemic? He admonishes states that are reopening too slowly and retweets a video about coronavirus cures that is so discredited that even Facebook deleted it. What does he do when the mayor of Portland asks him to stop sending armed federal agents to his city because the move is escalating political violence? He sends in more agents. Here is Democratic Congressman Jim Clyburn on MSNBC Sunday night, questioning Trump's pretext of sending them in to protect the federal buildings in Portland, which are usually protected by the local police. Let's listen.
If they need help in protecting those buildings, they would ask the federal government for help. Nobody asked the federal government to come into Portland. Nobody asked them to come to Seattle. This is something that's made up out of whole cloth by this administration as an excuse for sending in stormtroopers in order to incite people. Now, the local authorities are telling you that their presence does nothing but incite.
And it's not just Democrats like Congressman Clyburn. Here's conservative commentator Jonah Goldberg on Morning Edition today on what he sees going on in Portland.
I think the tragedy of the commons comes in where you have a handful of the protesters, not all of them to be sure, but you know, the rabble-rouser types who very much like the escalation and are provoking the Trump administration, and the Trump administration very much likes the escalation and are provoking the rabble-rousers, and you get this sort of race-to-the-bottom effect.
Jonah Goldberg on Morning Edition. And we will start there as we welcome NPR White House correspondent Aisha Roscoe. Hi, Aisha. We really appreciate you taking the time. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for having me.
So Portland first, then coronavirus and the virus relief bill. If we can, if the president is really doing what a large range of people from Jim Clyburn to Jonah Goldberg, and there's a big ideological range just between those two folks, say he's doing, he's playing a dangerous game with people's lives to make it look like it's him against disorder. What's the latest on what the White House is doing with this deployment?
Well, the White House is making this argument that they do have the right to send in federal agents to protect federal buildings. And they say that they have this right under the law. And so they are making the case that this is necessary. It is true that President Trump has tried to use Portland and kind of disorder in other and crime in other cities like Chicago as a way to paint himself as the law and order president and to make this case, and he has explicitly made this case a political case against former Vice President Joe Biden, saying that, well, in Biden's America, you won't be safe. But look at me, I'm keeping you safe. Now, this is an odd claim to make for an incumbent president to say that cities are getting out of control while he is president. But he is trying to make this argument. And I think part of it, you know, we'll talk about coronavirus later, mm-hmm. is because the coronavirus is not under control and people are scared about that. He's trying to make people scared about what's happening in the cities, because I think he feels like he has a better answer for that. And for the coronavirus, we've seen he hasn't had much of an answer.
Yeah. And you did a story last week, which I guess you indicated just now relates to both COVID and to Portland, on how the pandemic is changing the president's reelection strategy. So the pandemic and his sinking in the polls with respect to how he's handling the pandemic is not just affecting his behavior toward the pandemic, right?
No. It you can see that this at this point you have the president talking about law and order, talking about, you know, crime in Chicago, sending, you know, we're going to have to send in the agents, because this is, he has kind of latched on to that after the protest movements, after George Floyd, to say that, look, I can keep you safe, and also tying it to the suburbs. And he had that tweet last week where he talked about suburban housewives. So not really very subtle. I mean, reaching out almost really explicitly to this idea of, even though the suburbs are full of all sorts of people, but really you can tell that he's reaching out to a mostly white base, mm-hmm. really trying to reach out to white women and to say, look, don't be, you know, I know that you're worried about the coronavirus, but you really got to be afraid about, you know, what's happening in the suburbs. The crime in the city could come to you. And you know, it's a very, you know, it is really trying to appeal to racial grievance.
Yeah. Because those moms in the suburbs, and again, as you say, there are all kinds of moms in the suburbs, but yes. he's got this picture of white moms who he's talking to, and maybe even older white moms in particular, yes. because that's the base that he's starting to lose, with older people being vulnerable to the virus and him being perceived as mishandling the virus. That's the demographic that he's really sinking in, that he needs to hold if he's going to get reelected. But those suburban moms, they're not getting shot on the streets of Chicago. They're not involved in the violence in Portland, unless they're choosing to go downtown and be violent protesters. So he's talking about things that are irrelevant to the audience he's trying to scare. I think that's a really important kind of central organizing principle of American politics right at this moment. You know, one of the weird aspects of this that All Things Considered reported on yesterday was that right-wing anti-government people from the Western U.S., like the infamous right-wing protester Ayman Bundy, have joined the call against Trump's use of the police in Portland. That's from a right-wing libertarian viewpoint that's just for small government, and it even generalizes to this. So for you as a White House correspondent, what about all these small government Republicans in Congress? Are Rand Paul or anyone else raising their voices against the president appearing to escalate rather than de-escalate the Portland situation with government power?
You're not really hearing that. Or if you're hearing it, you're not hearing it very loudly. And this has been the case kind of, it seems like, over and over again with President Trump, where he will, you know, take these positions. I mean, you have a president right now who's very focused on executive orders. And if you remember, under the Obama administration, you had Republicans who were up in arms. No, you can't, you know, you're not an emperor, President Obama. You can't be doing all these executive orders. You have to go through Congress. Well, now you have a president under Trump who loves executive orders, and you're not seeing that pushback from Congress. So again and again, you kind of see that even these kind of small government conservatives who talk about, you know, needing protection from the federal government, who don't want people, you know, we don't want the federal government intruding in our lives, but they're not pushing back against the federal government going into these cities, even though local authorities say that they don't want them there.
Attorney General William Barr is testifying today before the House Judiciary Committee, led by New York Democrat Jerry Nadler. We have a late report that Nadler was uninjured but in a minor car crash, and so this is going to be delayed until later in the day, but it's still going to happen today. I'm passing this along largely for our local New York audience that knows Jerry Nadler well. He's been on this show so many times. Used to be when I went into our studio in Lower Manhattan, which is in his district and near where he lives, or one of his offices is, he would walk into our studio quite frequently to do interviews. I don't think he's walking to my apartment building in Upper Manhattan now. And I hope he's walking away from this accident. They do say that he's unhurt. And when Barr does testify, assuming that he's well enough for this to happen just a few hours later today, do you have any indication that Barr is ready to comment on these deployments in any way that's been reported?
He has certainly, been in the forefront talking about these deployments. It was interesting last week when they were talking about this Operation Legend, which went to Kansas City, named after a young boy who was killed in a shooting. When he was talking about sending out those deployments, he did make a lot of charges and arguments that are not really backed up by evidence or that we don't have any evidence for. He tried to make the case that crime is going up because there have been protests and because people are seeking to, kind of change policing or, the defund police, defund police campaign, saying that was driving crime. We don't have any evidence of that, and that's the case that he's been trying to make, that this stuff is necessary. It was also interesting because he basically said that they were going to send in federal agents to some cities, but just to kind of augment existing task forces, they would be going after people who were breaking federal crimes, but it wasn't clear exactly that they were expanding their mandate, but just saying their existing task force and forces, and that we're going to send more agents to help out with that. It's not clear how much on the ground dealing with crime, in a place like Chicago, or that it's going, the difference that it will make. Mm-hmm. and what the impact of it will actually be, because the federal government has said that they were helping out in these cities before, but you haven't really seen a difference.
So I asked you how Jerry Nadler is. I'm going to ask you how somebody else is. How's National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien, as far as you know, who it was reported yesterday, they disclosed yesterday, has the virus, the highest ranking Trump official to get it?
Yeah, well, according to the White House, he is suffering only mild symptoms. They didn't go deep into details about that, but they say that he is still working off-site. It appears, and what Larry Kudlow, who's the economic advisor for the White House, said, that they think that O'Brien got the coronavirus from his kind of college age daughter. And that they had went on a family vacation, and what is interesting about that is you have President Trump, who is pushing for schools to reopen, for colleges to reopen, and his argument is, well, kids, they, even if they get it, they'll be fine. But this is kind of like a clear example within his own administration of the risk of young people coming home and seeing their parents or their grandparents, is that they can spread the virus. Yeah. Right. And so that's the, it kind of crystallizes this argument when you talk about the risk of opening up, of reopening schools and reopening colleges, is that, it doesn't just stay with the young person. They can spread it to their family. So now you have the national security advisor, who presumably would be one of the safest people in the country. He's tested all the time. They're going to be looking at his health. He's not going to be meeting with just anybody. But of course he's going to be with his children. And so that's, so that's how he gets exposed. So how much more so for the average family who's not going to be tested every day, right? Not going to have the resources that the national security advisor has. So what does that mean for families? So it really kind of crystallized that point.
Has he been asked that question yet, the president? Besides the national security advisor Robert O'Brien story there of getting it from one of his kids, I don't know if you saw the latest Florida stat that they've had 8,000 children test positive in the last 8 days. That's 1,000 children a day testing positive for the virus in Florida, one of the most, maybe the most controversial state in terms of its reopening policies. And I see on your Twitter ID, you put this right at the top of your Twitter ID, so I assume that this is not a secret, that you're a mother of three.
Yes.
You won't be surprised to hear that many of my listeners are obsessed with what their kids' schools are going to do about reopening or not. How much is the president sticking to his position that schools should reopen, and not just reopen, but reopen with full attendance.
You know, he did seem to soften a bit last week. I have to say that the president has been all over the place when it comes to the coronavirus and not consistent. But last week he did, even though he was still pressing for schools to open in person, he seemed to acknowledge that in certain places where there are hot spots, and there are a lot of hot spots around the country at this moment, that you may not be able to open in person immediately, and that schools may need to hold off for a while. But the White House is still kind of putting forward this idea about trying to have money go not just to the schools, but try to have it go to the students, basically trying to give the option for parents who want their kids in schools to take federal money to send their kids to private schools if they're open. It's a way to try to pressure public schools to open up and to, you know, be in person so that they can get this money. And so there's still that pressure there, but President Trump did seem to acknowledge that in certain places it may not be appropriate. And really where you have a lot of community spread, which is really throughout the country, that's going to be an issue when it comes to reopening schools. And it's definitely on my mind as a mom of three young kids.
The president said yesterday that some states are reopening too slowly. Why did he say that in the midst of everything else we were just talking about?
You know, you get President Trump who is reading off of a teleprompter or who is reading his notes, and there'll be one message, and then you get the President Trump that is tweeting and just kind of talking off the cuff, and you get another President Trump. So he had been saying, you know, last week it'll get worse before it gets better. But he also said last week that he also still thinks the coronavirus will disappear one day. And so this week you get this message of where clearly we've had issues with reopening. We didn't have the recovery summer that President Trump thought, you know, or was claiming that we would have. There are clear issues with reopening, but he's still saying that, well, you know, I think some states could open a little faster because he was talking about the economy and he wants the economy to pick up. But we've seen states reopen and then have to start slowly shutting back down or shutting certain businesses back down because the virus is spreading.
And you know what I notice, I think, increasingly when it comes to the virus about the president, and I wonder if you have a take on this as a White House correspondent, he seems to be the king of the mixed message. And so one day he'll go out and wear a mask in public and say it's important that everybody wears masks and things are going to get worse before they get better, et cetera, et cetera. Then the next day he'll go out and say states are reopening too slowly. And it seems like he's playing both sides of the argument of whether the virus is a hoax. Not that there are two sides of that argument, you know, in science, but politically he seems to be playing both sides of that argument day after day after day. Is the mixed message a strategy as opposed to sticking to one side or the other?
There's definitely a mixed message. I don't know that it's a strategy, and more, I think that a lot of it is just the impulse and the fact that the virus is not something that the president can just kind of talk away. It's not something that he can just kind of talk over or, you know, do a positive spin on and it will just kind of fix itself. And it's not completely under his control. And so I think the president has in the past been able to say, okay, we have this problem and now we're fixing it. Now we're moving on, you know, or, you know, the wall's being built. It's being built now. And just been able to kind of plow through and kind of have, and to have people around him try to make that happen. You can't do that with the coronavirus. The coronavirus takes, you know, detailed decision making every single day. And it's not one decision and you're going to fix it. And so I think what you see is you see the president at times responding to polls that people don't like the way he was talking about the coronavirus, that his approval ratings went down on that. So trying to respond to that, but also trying to stick to this idea that, well, it'll just go away. And it'll just kind of this magical thinking of it will just go away and everything will be fine. And, you know, I don't like masks. I don't like this change. Instead of dealing with the reality that it's here and we have to deal with it. It's not going away.
Here's a question. This is an Ayesha Rascoe fan person question. I can't tell fanboy, fangirl. Fan person question on Twitter from Twitter user Malazy. So you could take that any number of ways. Call themselves Malazy. Asks, quote, how do you balance so well reporting ridiculousness statements coming out of the White House without legitimizing or overly mocking those statements? It's a rare gift that you have. Ha. And so besides the compliment, this is a trick for any reporter, right? If you know, no matter who you're covering really, but certainly in the age of Trump, to report without either legitimizing or overly mocking, or overtly mocking, as the writer says.
Yeah, you know, it's something that when it comes to reporting, I mean, I try to be as fair as possible, but I also want to be as truthful and honest as possible. So if someone says something and it's just not true, I want to say flat out, it is not true. I don't see that it serves anybody to try to, you know, make something out, you know, to not serve that. But I also try not to, you know, I try not to make fun of what someone is saying or to, you know, just go, oh, well, this is just ridiculous, right? Because there are people who feel that way, regardless of whether, you know, whether someone may agree, you know, what people, one person thinks is ridiculous, another person may not. And I don't feel like it's my job as a reporter to do that. What I try to do is lay out the facts as I know them, as best I know them. And I try to be as fair as possible. And I just try to stand on the side of the truth. And then you can, and I leave it to the listener to take from that and go, oh, well, that's ridiculous. Because that's, you can do that. The listener can do that. I don't need to do that.
Follow-up question of sorts, I think, from Leo in Milford, Pennsylvania. Leo, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi, Brian. Ayesha, big fans, both of you. You guys are doing fantastic jobs. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My question is, Ayesha, I have a question that I feel that the reporters are not pushing back on Trump, especially during this corona briefings or meetings that he has every day. And the only way the propaganda that Fox perpetrates can be, you know, dispelled or whatever is going back at him when he comes off the wall with things that are totally untrue. And I don't feel like the reporters are doing that. You know what I'm saying? And I don't know if it's because they're afraid that their credentials will be pulled from the White House or something along those lines.
What's it like at those briefings, Ayesha?
Well, I think, you know, I think what can be tough at those briefings is not necessarily, you're not concerned about your credentials being pulled, although the White House has tried that, but the courts have pushed back on that. They haven't been allowed to do that. So that's
a little thing called the First Amendment. Go ahead.
That's not really the concern. I think that at times it can be difficult. I think a lot of times people are asking the questions and trying to push back, but if someone is determined to not answer the question, you can't really force them to answer the question. And sometimes what they do is they're getting a follow-up and then they move on to another person, to another reporter, as kind of like a get out of jail free card. So they go, okay, you're asking me a tough question, I'm going to move on to this next person. Mm-hmm. And if that next reporter doesn't follow up on what the first reporter was saying, then they kind of get to move on and not really be pressed on it. But there have been times where you really did have reporters really trying to press. You know, this happened with Kayleigh McEnany when she was being asked about the Confederate flag, where you had reporters just keep coming back to it and kind of forcing her to deal with it. But if a person is at, there are times where you try to ask the question, but you know, the president or whoever, whatever lawmaker, just doesn't answer and just kind of filibusters. So it can be a difficult and frustrating situation.
Esha Roscoe is not the king of the mixed message. She's the queen of the straightforward reporting from the White House for NPR. And we thank, you know, people who listen to an individual NPR station, they don't always realize that NPR, it's an affiliate system of hundreds of radio stations. Yes. And for you as an NPR reporter, you are serving hundreds of radio stations in all 50 states with your reporting every day. So it's a special thing when you devote a half hour or so of your time to come on one station for one set of local listeners, as you did with us today. And we always appreciate when you do it. So Aisha, thank you so much.
Thank you. I really appreciate being on.
Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at wnyc.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.